Mark was. The first on Mark. How do you guys feel about that? Sure, okay. But I can still ask them how they did.
First one or the second one?
Sorry?
First one or the second one?
The first one, yeah. The second one I've only just given you. So I if you've done it already, that's great. But I've not had a huge amount of experience teaching, but I've taught enough to know that if the students do the homework problems on the first 3 days of the week that it's due, that's extremely rare. So I'm not actually expecting that to be done already. No, the first one. That was okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then are there any questions on stuff we did last week or the week before?
Can I ask about the current homework?
Sure. I don't have a copy of it here, but you go ahead.
I don't have it in front. Oh, there it is. Just 2B with the black box where we're trying to find pairs that map to the same.
Yeah.
Even with a hint, I'm still a little lost.
Well, okay, then you'll have to spend some time, more time thinking about it. That one's the hardest one on the problem set. So, you know, if you can't get it, then you can't get it. But I think it's good to spend time trying to, you know, trying different things, because that kind of, that's where you learn, really.
Yeah. Well.
So, if you have a specific question, I can certainly try to answer that.
I did, but I forgot it. Sorry.
Okay. Well, some other time. Okay. Any other questions on the lectures? Okay, so what I wanted to do today, so this week in general, we're kind of doing a bit of a grab bag of different things. Today, we're going to do quantum cryptography. Tomorrow, quantum error correction, you know, assuming I can keep on track. Blending kind of on Wednesday into other kinds of quantum communication things. So these first 3 days will mostly be about different kinds of quantum communication. And then my hope is that we can finish that by Wednesday, and then Thursday and Friday I'll talk about implementations. And even so, there's a theme in that today and tomorrow, the stuff we're going to be talking about will require a lot less physical effort to build than a full-scale quantum computer, the stuff we talked about last week. So for instance, quantum cryptography has already been implemented. And if I have time today, I'll say at least a little bit about how they do that. Quantum error correction, which I'll talk about tomorrow, is not, well, it's kind of been implemented. I mean, there have been demonstrations of it. It hasn't, we don't have a big enough quantum computer yet to do useful quantum error correction, in that it actually could help us do something, you know, store quantum states that we were interested in. But at least the basic approach for it has been done. Okay, so quantum cryptography. So I talked a little bit about cryptography last week in the context of RSA. So the idea of cryptography, of course, you have Alice and Bob, and they want to communicate secretly. So Alice wants to send a message to Bob. The problem is that there's an eavesdropper, Eve, who's listening in. And Eve can hear or read or whatever everything they send. But she doesn't have access to, Alice and Bob each have a private space, you know, their own computer. And Eve doesn't have access to that. Okay, so the idea is that Alice and Bob are going to have to somehow encrypt their message, or Alice is sending to Bob, so she's going to have to somehow encrypt her message in such a way that Bob is able to read it, but Eve is not. Okay? Because whatever she sends, Eve is going to be able to look at. So the she can't hide it necessarily from Eve, but she can make sure that Eve can't get any useful information out of it. And so RSA was the way to do that, remember. So RSA, I had the people reversed then, but in RSA, in this case, Bob would have, Alice would have a public key that would enable her to encrypt the message, and then Bob has a private key that lets him decrypt it and read it. Eve doesn't have the private key, so she can't read it. Okay? But today, I want to talk about some other kind of encryption. So in particular, let's start with the one-time pad. So the one-time pad is a very simple encryption scheme. It's actually maybe about 100 years old, called the Vernon cipher when it was invented. And the way it works is pretty straightforward. So Alice and Bob will share some long key. Which is just a string of random bits. Okay. And so this is different from RSA. In RSA, Alice and Bob use different keys to encrypt and decrypt. In the one-time pad, you use the same key to do both. Okay. So they both have K. And so this private key K has to be kept secret. Eve cannot learn the private key, because otherwise he'd have the same information as Bob does, and therefore be able to decrypt just as well as he can. Okay? And in the one-time pad, so what's going to happen is Alice converts her message to a string of bits. And of course, you can do that using any of the methods we talked about before. She writes it as a series of letters and converts each letter to ASCII, and then that's a number, and she puts those numbers together. Okay, and so that's going to be M. And what she sends then is what did I call it? E is M plus K. So this is the bitwise XOR. XOR is, or C0, right? So in other words, whenever what she does, she lines up the bits of M and K. And whenever K has a 0 bit, she sends the bit of M. And whenever K has a 1 bit, she sends the opposite from the bit of M. Okay. Now, if you don't think about it the right way, you might say, how is that possibly secure? She's sending half the bits of M. Right? Because half the time, K is a 0, and so she sends a bit of M. But the key is that if you look at each bit in isolation, it's equally likely to be the bit of M or the opposite from the bit of M. Right? In other words, it's totally random if you don't know K. Okay? If you do know K, well, then it's very easy to decode. So what he does is he takes E plus K, so he takes the bitwise XOR again. He has K, remember. And well, that's equal to M plus K, which is equal to M again. Right? Because whenever K is a 0, he leaves it alone, the bit of E, and it was the same as M, so that's good. And whenever K is 1, he flips it. And since Alice flipped it before, he's flipped it, it's now been flipped twice, and it's back to the same bit as M. Okay? But since Eve doesn't know K, so to her, each bit looks completely random. Okay? So the thing about this encryption scheme is it's totally secure. Okay? This is sometimes referred to as information theoretic security. So people in the quantum information arena tend to refer to this and quantum cryptography, which we'll get to in a minute, as unconditionally secure. I don't really like that, and a lot of classical cryptographers don't like that term either, because it's not really true that there's no conditions, right? So, well, there's various conditions, some of which we'll get to later, one of which I've already told you, right, which is that Eve doesn't have access to Alice and Bob's computer, right? If Eve is looking over Alice's shoulder when she writes the message, then it doesn't really help what she does in the communications line, okay? But assuming we satisfy this assumption and you know everything else is meets the ideal implementation of this protocol, Eve really has no information at all about Alice and Bob, no matter what, her computational power. Okay, so that's what this means. So this is in contrast to RSA, where if Eve could factor large numbers, for instance, if she had a quantum computer, she could break RSA. So this, there's no computational problem that Eve can solve that's going to help her defeat this, right? Because from her point of view, K is totally random. So every possible message is equally likely based on the ciphertext she sees. This thing that gets sent is called the ciphertext. OK? Everyone understand that? OK, so but this one-time CAD is obviously a very secure scheme. And it's actually used in the real world for people that need really, really high security, you know, like national governments communicating with their ambassadors overseas or their spies or things like that. OK? But it does have some defects. And So what are the defects of one-time CAD? OK, so first of all, K must be kept secure. Obviously, because if Eve learns it, then she can break the message easily. So this is one of the main motivations for going to RSA or another kind of public key protocol. Because that way, at least the encryption key doesn't need to be kept secure. Right? You need the person sending the message to know the public key, but if somebody else learns it too, that doesn't hurt you. Right? That's kind of built into the protocol. The private key needs to be kept secure, but you don't need to send that anywhere. So that's maybe a little easier to do. Whereas in this case, you need Alice and Bob. They're far apart, presumably. Otherwise, why do they need cryptography? And somehow, they need to share this key. So they're together at some point in the past, so maybe they share the key then. Or maybe you have to send some kind of trusted courier between the two of them to carry a key from one person to another. And that's a little risky, because you know you trusted this person, but what if you were wrong too? Okay. The other problem, well, is maybe you can figure it out from the name, which is that K can only be used once. Well, why is that? So, and in fact, in particular, it needs to be as long as the message. Okay, so why is this? Well, basically, because the way this protects the system, the encrypted message, is by making the bits look totally random. Okay, but if you're XORing with the same K more than once, then that's a pattern and one you can take advantage of. So for instance, if you use it twice, well, so you have M1 plus K, and M2 plus K. And if you add those together, so if Eve collects two such messages and adds them together, then what she's got is M1 plus M2. K has disappeared altogether. Now, this is still kind of a mishmash of the two things. But if you're clever, you can frequently figure out quite a lot about both messages and maybe even totally decode them. And in fact, in the Cold War, there was a case where the Soviet Union accidentally used some one-time pad pages twice due to some kind of manufacturing problem wherever they made them. And the US was actually able to decode a large number of their messages based solely on this fact. Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know the details, but I imagine that they were doing some kind of analysis. I mean, they didn't know it was a one-time pad even that they were using. There's other there's other crypto systems and they must have just tried, you know, some sort of statistical analysis and said, well, hold on, there's some pattern here and here, and they worked it out basically something like that. In general, if it's not a one-time pad, there will be patterns. They might be much harder to detect or figure out, but that's how people do it, is they look at for frequencies of different symbols and so on. One of the classical solutions to this, well, you can go to something like RSA that based on computational security. RSA is relatively weak because it has this public key property. That's very nice, but the computational strength is not so great. There's other systems like AES is an example, which is called a symmetric crypto system. So AES, it does have a shared private key. Alice and Bob use the same one, and it's computationally secure. But you can use the key over and over again. So it's kind of somewhere in that sense. And the computational structure is presumably harder to break than factoring. So it's kind of somewhere in between the one-time pad and RSA in usefulness and security. OK, yeah?
What was the Enigma machine?
The Enigma machine was another example of a symmetric crypto system. So public key cryptography wasn't invented until the 60s or 70s. Actually, it was invented, I think, in the 60s by someone in the British, I forget what it's called, but the British Code Agency. And that nobody knew about that until quite recently. But then it was publicly invented, in the public sector in the 1970s. So anything older than that is symmetric key cryptography. And cryptography, of course, goes back thousands of years. So Enigma was a symmetric crypto system. They were special machines that were built to do the encryption and the decryption. And the key, they had some gears that they were supposed to set, or knobs, or I forget exactly what it is, but some mechanical thing that they were supposed to set. And the settings of those things was the key. And so each day they had to use a different key. And you'd use the same key to encrypt the message, and then the way the machine was set up, if you fed an encrypted, maybe there was another flip you could switch you could flip to run it backwards, that would then decrypt the message. But again, since it was not the one-time pad, it was not completely secure, and so the Allies were able to break it in a lot of cases during the war. And this was one of the motivations, in fact, for the invention of computers in World War II, was in order to break the Enigma system. This was the German encryption system. I don't know if all of you know any of this history. And so the Allies wanted to, of course, break the messages, not just eventually, but right away, so that they could, respond appropriately if necessary. So they needed, better and better computing devices in order to break these things quickly. And so kind of some of the first computers were built for exactly that purpose. Okay. So anyway, so that's a bit of a side thing. So where does quantum cryptography come in? Well, quantum cryptography is going to be an add-on to a one-time pad, basically. You can use it for other things, because private keys can be used for a lot of different crypto tasks. But the point is to kind of limit the difficulty of distributing the secret key. So in fact, the most common quantum cryptography system is called quantum key distribution. Or QKD for short. So the idea of quantum key distribution is that Alice and Bob are going to use quantum states in order to distribute a secret key K without the eavesdropper learning it. So how does that work? So in this case, we have Alice and Bob. And they're going to communicate over a quantum channel. And we'll assume that Eve is here potentially listening in. And Eve can do whatever she wants to this quantum channel. Okay? She can you know, measure states that go through it. So a quantum channel is a communications channel that you send quantum states over. And Eve can measure states that go through it. She can throw away the quantum channel and replace it with one of her own. She can, you know, take the states, store them for later, and, you know, send something else on to Bob, whatever she wants. Okay? She can have her own quantum computer that she entangles with the quantum states going through this communications channel, anything. Okay? And then on top of this, Alice and Bob are going to communicate classically. Okay? And then Eve can listen in on that too. Okay? Obviously, if they had a secret classical communications channel, it would be easy to create secret key. They would just send the key along that. Yeah?
Can Eve introduce errors into the classical
channel? No, she cannot. And I'm going to get back to that briefly, at least, later on. But for the moment, let's assume she can just listen. And I'll explain why we need that. Okay? Okay. So, I have space here. Okay. So how does QKD work? So there's a bunch of steps. I want to go through them carefully. So in the first step, Alice is going to generate a bunch of random bits. Call them big N pairs. And let's call these AI and RI. So I goes from 1 to N. OK? And this AI, together, each AI and RI is going to tell her a particular state of a qubit. And she's going to send that qubit to Bob. OK? So in particular, AI is going to tell her what basis to use. And RI is going to tell her what state to use within that basis. So so suppose we have them. AI is 0. Well, in that case, the state that corresponds is going to be the computational basis, 0 or 1. Okay. And suppose her bit AI is 1. Well, then we're going to use the Hadamard rotated basis, plus or minus. So plus, of course, is 0 plus 1. And minus is 0 minus 1. OK? And so then the second step, of course, Alice sends the corresponding qubits to Bob. OK? And then Bob, well, as he receives these qubits, he's going to measure them. So Bob chooses a random basis BI. For each qubit. and measures it in that basis. Okay? Everyone got it so far? Okay, so this is kind of the end of the quantum part of the protocol. And everything else they do is going to be classical. So far, we've only used this quantum channel. Right? Of course, at home, they've done some classical stuff, too. Alice has generated some random bits. And now Bob has generated some random bits. But now they're going to have to talk classically in order to get a useful key out of it. So why is that? Well. So what happens if Alice prepares the zero basis, but then Bob measures the one basis? Or vice versa. Maybe it's easy to see if Alice prepares the one basis, and then Bob measures the zero basis. Right? Well, if Bob measures this plus state in the zero basis, he'll get 0 and 1 with equal probability. And similarly, if he received the minus state, he'll get 0 and 1 with equal probability. Right? You won't be able to tell the difference between the plus and the minus. So he's not really getting any useful information, and if he measures the wrong basis. It works the same way, right, if he's measuring the plus minus basis relative to the 0, 1 states. Again, it's totally random. Okay. So what's going to happen is, so using the classical channel, Alice and Bob will announce AI and BI. And if they're the same, then they keep bit I. And if they're different, they discard it. Oh, so Alice is generating these at home in her thing, and she hasn't told them to Bob yet. So Bob doesn't know what AI and RI are at this point when he receives the qubits. Okay, so that's why he's generating his own random basis and measuring in that basis. Okay, in a second we can discuss what would have happened if Alice announced her things while she was sending the qubits. The problem is that then that would help Eve too. So okay, so. So if the bases are differently, they're going to throw things out. But if the bases are the same, well, if there's nothing else going wrong, if there's no interference, then, if Alice sent this state and Bob measures in this basis, then he'll get the same state that Alice sent. And similarly, if it's the one basis. Right? So in other words, in a perfect world, So let's suppose that when Bob measures, he gets the result SI. Okay. So in a perfect world, if AI equals BI, then the bit that Alice sent, RI, is equal to the bit that Bob received, SI. Okay? But of course, the world is not perfect. There might be, you know, noise in the communications channel causes errors. But and it turns out that Eve can cause errors too. Okay, so how does that work? Well, so if Eve wants to interfere, I mean, her goal is not to mess them up. She can do that actually quite easily. But she wants to actually learn the secret key. So suppose Eve decides to measure. As they pass. Okay? So for instance, suppose suppose Alice sends 0. Okay? Now if Eve happens to measure in the 0-1 basis, then she'll learn that bit. Okay, so that's good for her. But what happens if she doesn't know that it was sent in this basis, right? It could have been sent in the other basis. So what happens if she decides to measure in the other basis? Well, she could get 0 plus 1 or 0 minus 1. She could get either state. Suppose she gets 'plus' state, and then sends that state. She records that. She records that she got the plus because it might be the key bit. But then she has to send something to Bob so that Bob doesn't get suspicious. And so she sends 'plus' on to Bob. Now, why should she send 'plus'? Well, suppose Alice actually did use the '± basis, so Eve guessed right. Well, then she wants to send on the right bit, right, to make as little problem as possible. But in this case, she guessed wrong. So then Bob, even if he happens to measure in the 0-1 basis, so he chooses bi equals 0, but he still might get an error. He still might measure and get 1. Right? And so that would mean that si was not equal to ri for this particular value of I. Okay? So in the tutorial today, you're going to analyze this kind of eavesdropping strategy a bit more carefully. But my point is, in bringing this up, is just that if Eve tries to measure the qubits, she'll cause errors. And actually, if you think about it, you can see that this type of thing has to be generic. If she wants to do any kind of measurement of the states, she's going to disturb them, right? She's going to change the quantum states. That's inherent in quantum measurement. That measurement implies disturbance. Okay? And so by doing so, she's always going to introduce errors. Okay? And this is the central point of quantum cryptography. So the whole point of quantum key distribution is Alice and Bob, they can communicate over this quantum channel, and Eve can listen if she wants. She can do anything if she wants. But if she does, Alice and Bob will be able to detect that. And so if she doesn't do anything, then the key will be secure. They can use it safely. And if she does, then they know she's done that, and they know not to use the key for any secret messages, anything that they want to keep from her. Okay? Yeah?
You said if something's something, then they know that she has an
eavesdropper. Yeah, so I'm going to get to the details of exactly how they figure that out. That's the next step. But I might as well write that, actually, in fact. It's very easy. So step five, what's going to happen is Alice and Bob choose a random subset of bits and announce them. So they announce RI and SI. This is over the classical channel. and compare to determine an error rate. So if the error rate is too high, they throw away the key. They abort. Otherwise, they continue. We had a backlog of questions. So.
My question is, if the idea was to send bits to vault, why the second condition, when bit I is different from AI, so what would be the fit for that bit to AI?
When BI is not equal to AI.
Yes.
No, those bits are just wasted.
Okay.
The point is not just to communicate between Alice and Bob, but they want to communicate secretly. Okay. So to do that, they end up using more qubits than the total number of bits they're going to communicate secretly. But the point is they're kind of different resources. Things through the quantum channel are in some sense cheaper than the secret bits that they're trying to get.
No, I didn't
know. No, okay. Chris.
So how does that, once they have an error rate, mm-hmm. they still have errors with their respective bits, and if you try to throw it into something like one-time pad, that means there's...
Yeah. So they're gonna. So this is not the end of the protocol. They're going to have to do more stuff. Okay. But before I get to that, let me back up a little bit and say, well, what if we had done this protocol slightly differently? So for instance, what if Alice had announced AI and RI while she was sending her qubits? Right? That way, Bob wouldn't have to guess what basis to measure in. And they wouldn't have to throw out half the qubits or half the bits that they get. Well, the problem is that if Alice announces AI, well, if she announces RI, then the game is over. Because Alice knows what these Eve knows what these prospective qubits are. But if Alice just announces AI, well, so Bob knows what to measure. And the problem is that Eve then also knows what to measure. Okay? And so then when Eve gets the qubits, instead of having to guess what basis to measure, you'll just measure in the right basis. And if you measure in the right basis, then you don't create a disturbance, right? If the state is actually 0 or 1 and you measure in the 0 or 1 basis, then it'll stay 0 or 1. You'll always get the right answer. And so Eve will know everything. And she won't reveal her presence to Bob, because you can just send on whatever she got. Okay? So it's only by having this uncertainty that really makes it a quantum system. Uncertainty as the basis that really makes it a quantum system and protects against Eve's measurement. I should say that it doesn't require that Eve do measurement, right? If she does more general things, she entangles with the state that she's keeping. That also creates an error that Bob will detect. Because then the states that's getting sent onto them are not pure states. They're mixed states that are entangled. And they're not the correct ones. That's the important thing. OK. So let's finish the protocol. So at this point, Alice and Bob, they have these shared random bits. But some of them are wrong. And all they really know is that the error rate in them is below some particular value, which is going to have to come out of security proof. So how do they fix that up? Well, they use classical error correction. Tomorrow we'll talk about quantum error correction. But maybe I'll give you some classical error correction in the problem set. But the basic idea is they use some classical error correcting code. And based on that, they compute an error syndrome and compare. So I'm still not sure what the right way to order this class would have been. So maybe it would have made sense to do error correction first. But for other reasons, I wanted to do it this way around. Using this tells them some information. So I mean, there's some details which are hard to explain if you don't know much about classical error correction. But the basic idea is using this, they can figure out where the errors are, assuming the error rate, again, is not too large. And then they can correct them. Okay, and so then they really will have the same bit string. So this costs them something. So the problem is that when they announce these error syndromes, they're revealing something about the bit string that they have. Okay, so they need to remove some bits to compensate for that. Okay, so by doing this, the thing gets shorter again. And how much shorter depends on what the error rate is. If it's a very high error rate, then it shrinks a lot. And if it's a very low error rate, then it only shrinks a little bit. Yeah?
Is there if I can do anything on the channel when it's going to be now? If I know that I want to have information access, can I not have the information I need and then I restore the bit to the original state that it was passing so that the person don't?
No, right, because this is a quantum state. So anything you do it not just disturbs the state, but it's irreversible, right? Because we can't copy the state ahead of time, right? She can't copy it so that she has, you know, a safe copy to pass on the bob. That would violate the no cloning theorem. So really, anything that you've done. Obviously, what I've said here is not a proof that there's nothing that Eve can do. To do a proof, you have to go through the whole protocol and say, looking at this as a whole, is there anything Eve can do that will let her get information out? It turns out that that's been done, and in fact, this system is secure. When you do that, you find out, for instance, what error rate you have to use. If this error rate is too high, then Eve actually can get information. Because, you know, she measures, she gets some information when she measures. That introduces some errors. But Alice and Bob don't want to totally rule out the possibility of errors, because there will be errors whenever they use it. Right? It's the world is not perfect, so the communications channel is not going to be perfect. But they don't really know whether those errors are due to the communications channel being imperfect or whether it's due to the presence of Eve. Okay? So to be safe, they assume it's always due to Eve. And they want to use an error rate that's low enough that they can still exclude her. Okay? But this brings up another issue. If the error rate they measure is low, so they don't want to throw it out because it could be occurring naturally, that means that it could be that Eve measured a few of those bits, right, and got a little bit of information, right? In this example, she measured in the wrong basis, so she didn't get anything useful. But if she'd happened to measure in the right basis, then she would have learned a bit, right? And in particular, if she happens to measure in the right basis, then she can send it on, and that won't cause an error. So if she only measures a few bits, she might get lucky. And even if Alice and Bob, you know, have a zero tolerance for error, they still might not detect it. Okay? So at this point, Eve might know a few bits. So we have to do something called privacy amplification. So I don't want to really go into the details of that, but the basic idea is one way to do it is Alice and Bob choose some random subsets. Of bits. So in this case, they're choosing which subset. They're not going to announce the values of those bits because they want them to be secret. But what they do is they take the parity of all the bits in each subset. And use those as their secret key bits. Okay, so the idea here is suppose you have 10 bits, okay, and Eve has measured some of them. So maybe she knows 3 of those bits. Okay, the other 7 are secret, but you don't know which ones are secret. So you don't know which ones you can safely use. But the idea is if you take the parity, so you say how many of these bits are 1, Is it even or odd? Okay? So that's only one bit of information, so one secret key bit. But the advantage is that even if Eve knows three of them, she still doesn't know the parity, right? Even if she knows nine of them, she still doesn't know the parity. Because the 10th one, if it's 0 or 1, that will decide the parity. Right? So from her point of view, the 10th bit is totally random. And so it's equally likely that the parity is 0 or 1. Right? Suppose the 9 that she knows have even parity, and the last one is 0, then overall you have even parity. But if the last one is 1, then overall you have odd parity. And those are equally likely from her point of view. Okay? So that's the idea of this privacy amplification. So by choosing parities of a bunch of bits, then they can kind of push out Eve's information and get something that's more secure. In doing this, they end up with fewer bits again than they started with. But the advantage is that at the end of it, they can be sure that Eve doesn't even know one bit of information. She has, you know, some very small probability of knowing one bit. Yeah.
First, they have to say, oh, it's the general, which subsets they think.
That's right. Yeah.
They don't get hurt, right, if they say like beforehand, like before everything
starts. So it turns out that they do get hurt, and the reason is that Eve has strategies. So if Eve knew that they only were interested in the parity of these 10 bits, then Eve, instead of making a measurement of the bits individually, she'd make some kind of collective measurement that would give her information about the parity and nothing else. So this is not totally true, actually. Let me think. Actually, it turns out, I think, that having the random bases is probably enough already to exclude her from doing that. But usually, in the secure versions, we assume that they wait until afterwards. Since they have to compare information anyway, they might as well do it afterwards rather than before. It kind of gives them more advantage over Eve.
Because I don't have to do this, but if on LS, like I could prevent you from making collective measurements, right? Because I can like send pulses of light down a fibroptic cable, and then only send the next one after Bob has told me I received.
Yeah, you can do that if you want. The problem is it's kind of slow. Okay, so it's usually much better. You want to send the photons kind of continuously. Bob measures them at the receive, and then after you've done a bunch, maybe then you start generating this classical communications to figure out what the actual key should be. So something I guess I didn't maybe make explicit before. So I said, you know, Alice can't announce this AI before or at the same time that she's sending the qubit. But it's worth noting that it doesn't hurt her to announce it afterwards, or at least it doesn't hurt her very much, right? Because Eve has already had to send something onto Bob. Okay, so Eve, well, eventually she learns the basis that Alice and Bob were using. She's already lost the qubit. Or if she kept the qubit, then she had to send some junk onto Bob. So then she can learn what Alice sent, but Bob has junk, and he'll see that as an error. Okay. So it's kind of too late for her to really take advantage of this basis information once Bob has received it. Okay? Okay. So some notes to make about this protocol. But first of all, what's it called? So this particular protocol is called BB84. Okay, this is named after the inventors, Bennett and Broussard. And of course, 84 doesn't stand for somebody's name, it's year 1984. So some more notes. So obviously what I've shown you so far is not a proof that this thing is secure. But security proofs do exist. There, it's a bit difficult because Eve can do anything. She doesn't have to treat the qubits individually. As I said, she could make some kind of collective measurement on them to try to extract global information. And she can do it in such a way that she's only kind of, she can't ignore these later steps, but she wants to take advantage of them, right? She doesn't want to cause errors in the individual bits. She just wants to bypass that and learn the final key bits that Alice and Bob are generating. And so maybe there's some, you know, horrible entangled operation that she can do. She entangles with her own quantum computer, then she waits and makes a measurement once she learns all the classical information that Alice and Bob are sending back and forth. But security proofs exist. At least for the idealized version of the protocol. And so I believe the best one says that the allowable error rate is about 20%. Okay, so that's quite high, and that requires, in the end, I mean, between the error correction and the privacy amplification you have to do, you're only getting, you know, some vanishingly small fraction of the bits that actually turn into qubits. You're much better off if the error rate is below 10%, say. But in principle, if the error rate they have is 20%, there's some kind of communication they can do, some error correction and some privacy amplification procedure that will give them a secure key. Okay, so I also want to get back to this point about the classical channel. So the classical channel we can't allow Eve to change it. So why is that? Well, if Eve could change it, she could do what's called a man-in-the-middle attack. So maybe woman in the middle would be appropriate since it's Eve, but it's called man in the middle. And the idea here is that Eve, well, whenever she gets a qubit from Alice, she keeps it, and she generates her own qubit, just totally independently of Alice's, and sends it on to Bob. Okay? And then whenever she gets a message from Alice, well, she receives it, she blocks the classical communication from going any further to Bob. And she responds to Alice just as if she were Bob. Okay? And she can do that because she's got all the qubits that Alice sent to Bob. Right? So she can pretend to be Bob and run through this whole protocol talking to Alice and generate a secret key with Alice. I mean, it won't really be secret because Eve knows it, of course, but Alice thinks it's secret. And on the other side, she sends qubits to Bob. And whenever Bob says something, she blocks that from getting to Alice and responds to Bob just as if she were Alice. Okay? So she can pretend to be Bob when talking to Alice and pretend to be Alice when talking to Bob. And both of them think they're generating a secret key with each other, but they're actually just generating a secret key with Eve. Okay? And in that case, well, Alice encrypts using that secret key, and then Eve can read it because she has a secret key. And then if she wants, she can even re-encrypt it and send it on to Bob. So Bob still doesn't know anything is wrong, even though Eve has read the message. Okay? So this thing becomes totally insecure if Eve can make any changes she wants in this classical channel. So luckily, there's already classical solutions to this. So what you have to do is you have to authenticate. The classical channel. So there's various ways to do this. I certainly don't want to get into the details. But so one way uses shared private key. Now this, you might say, is a little perverse. They need to have some private key, and they use it up in authenticating the classical channel in order to generate private key. Right? What's the point of that? You're using private key to make private key. But the point is that the amount of private key you need to authenticate is much less than the amount you need to encrypt. Right? To encrypt using the one-time pad, well, the key had to be as long as the message. But to authenticate messages, you can make do with much less. So it turns out that roughly log n bits are needed. And therefore, you can start with a little bit of private key and use quantum key distribution to generate a lot of private key. So you're really winning. Yeah. N. So the number of, I didn't say, but the number of key bits that they get out here in the end, typically we consider it big N to be very large. And in that case, the number of bits they're getting out in the end is proportional to big N. So what that constant of proportionality depends on, what the error rate is that they're measuring and what protocol they're using exactly for the error correction and privacy amplification. But they're already always throwing away at least half. But they could be throwing away much more, or maybe just a little more. So let's say a quarter. They're keeping a quarter of the bits. So the point is log n is much less than n over 4. Yeah. So the way authentication works is you take the message that you want to send, you just send that regularly. Assuming you don't also want to encrypt it, which in this case you don't. And then you add on some extra tag that's associated with the specific message. Okay? And it can't be uniquely, because it's much shorter, it can't be unique for that message. But the idea is it depends on this private key Alice and Bob share in such a way that it's very hard for Eve to guess another message that has the same tag. And the problem is that as the messages get longer and longer, there's more and more messages that have the same tag. So it's not totally true. It depends on exactly what you want for security parameters, but that's roughly speaking why you need it to increase. I'm not totally sure of that number. It's not exactly log n. There's some other factors in it. But I think roughly log n is good enough for these purposes. Okay. So I'm pretty much out of time, but let me just say one or two words about implementation. So obviously, if you want to do a quantum communications protocol like this, the natural thing to use to send your qubits are photons, right? They travel very easily. So we can do QKD experimentally. And either you send photons through optical fibers, that's a natural thing to do. Because we have them all over the place. You can't quite use the full communications infrastructure we have built up. This works well. Through open air. And in fact, between PI, the other building, and IQC, there's a QKD system set up in open air. I'm sure if you ask the appropriate people, they'll be glad to show it to you. So one end is in Ray LaFlamme's office at PI. PI does not really have an experimental setup. And I think somebody told me that Kevin Resch is now running that experiment. So probably it's better to ask one of the grad students. But OK. Let's see. So in this idealized protocol, you'd like to send just a single photon. It's a bit hard to generate single photons. So frequently what they do is they use weak coherent states. So if you don't know what a coherent state is, I don't have time to tell you today. Maybe we'll get back to it later in the week. But the upshot is that most of the time, So let's say you use about 0.1. That's kind of a typical number. So most of the time, there's no photons. So you're actually just sending vacuum. But then 10% of the time, you have one photon. And then maybe about 1% of the time, you have two or more photons. OK, so this case is bad. You don't want to do that. It turns out that this creates potential security problems. So that's why you want to make this a low number, to decrease the number of two photon states. I haven't decided yet what's going to be on the last homework, but it's possible I'll give this to you and have you analyze why this is a problem. But if this is low enough, then, well, maybe you don't want to ignore it completely, but it's not such a big problem. So that's why they like to use, say, 10%. Let's see, other issues. Well, you have loss in the system. So first of all, loss in the channel. And the detectors have imperfect efficiency. In fact, for telecom wavelengths, they tend to have pretty lousy efficiency. So what I mean by that is kind of maybe in the 5 to 15% range. So that means that, so 5% efficiency means that for every photon that hits the detector, there's only a 5% chance the detector says, I saw a photon. Okay, so you're losing 19 out of 20. 5% is pretty low, but so luckily in this idealized protocol, this kind of thing doesn't really matter, right? Because they're throwing out half the bits anyway. It's only the ones that are received that are important. But it turns out that, again, it's an imperfection in system. And different kinds of imperfections, while maybe not a problem by themselves, can combine to present security problems. The simplest security proofs just work for this ideal perfect system. But you need to account for realistic imperfections as well. Not just in the channels, but in the things on Alice and Bob's end. Since I'm over time, maybe I'll stop there. Depending on, I haven't worked out the implementations lectures yet, but maybe we can talk a little bit more about some of the optics issues involved. But this gives you some idea. And nevertheless, people, so this sets a range limit before you lose too many photons. And that's maybe roughly on the order of 100 kilometers. Okay, and that's not bad if you're communicating from PI to IQC, but it was maybe a bigger problem if you want to communicate across the ocean or something like that. And so people have various ideas to do that. One of them uses, in fact, quantum error correction to make quantum repeaters that would let you kind of correct for loss and other errors and send much further. Another one is to use this open error quantum cryptography to communicate with a satellite, which could then communicate somewhere very far away. And the reason that's possible is a satellite doesn't have to be very far up. But more to the point, it's the air that causes the problem. Sending it through space is not such a big deal. And the air is only near the ground. So OK, so why don't I leave it at that for now?